call for the next speaker. Actually, the next speaker will be Ken Kellerman, followed by Leonie Lovitz.
Try to fix the resolution, that would take the rest of the half hour. In the spring of 1965, as the Northern Spring, IAU Information Bulletin A3 contained an article by Nadia Sholomitsky on the variability of CTA 102, radio variability, which was unknown at the time. Radio sources didn't vary except for supernovae. The immediate reaction in the West was, it's wrong, it's got to be wrong. There were follow-up publications in the Astronomical Journal and some other publications, but none of the publications gave any details of this remarkable discovery. Nothing was said about the antenna that was used, nothing was said about the instrumentation or the techniques and how they observed. I had up data at the same wavelength, approximately the same time over a period of time, didn't show any variability. Arecibo, as was mentioned earlier, had observations, similar frequency, didn't show any variability. Perhaps more important was we knew it was theoretically impossible. And we knew that Sklosky and his colleagues knew it was theoretically impossible. Sklosky had developed the theory. And now, the now familiar story, if something varies in the time scale of 100 days, it can't be larger than the order of 100 light days, it's smaller than 100 light days, and we lose a quasar with a redshift of 1, for the redshift distance of 1. The angular size has to be very small, and the brightness temperatures greatly exceeds the universe complement. Also, it had a 100-day period, very similar to CTA catalog number 102. And stories came out in the first in the Soviet media and in the Western media that the Sholomitsky and his colleagues had interpreted this as due to an extraterrestrial intelligence signal. Well, we learned later that the antenna was used, was a military space tracking antenna, it was all very secret, which is why they didn't give any of the observational details. Sklosky got a special commission to Sholomitsky, which is, was a graduate student at the time. So he was, his name was also unknown to the West. He used this antenna. The we now know that it does vary with approximately the time scale and approximately the amplitude. Sholomitsky claim. We now understand that it is theoretically possible due to the relativistic beaming. And we also learned much later that this whole story about the extraterrestrial intelligence was just a spoof from Sklosky and Sholomitsky and Kardashev with the Soviet press. And this is a picture of Sholomitsky. Kardashev immediately after a press conference sitting outside in front of the institute having a good laugh. And so Lena is going to tell the rest of the story of what really happened at the time in the Soviet Union.
Thank you. Well, it's a little humility for me to talk at this session on this topic since most people at this session were able to speak in the first person. I cannot. At the time of these developments, I was advancing through my primary school, and I can assure you that variability of extragalactic or any other sources was not my top item of my agenda. Anyway, in the middle of, this session is called 50 Years of Golden Decade in Astronomy. The decade of 1960s can be also called Golden Decade of Moscow School of Astrophysics, which at that time was very much dominated by these five outstanding people. I believe that I don't need to comment too much on their contribution to astrophysics. They were mostly theoreticians. Sklosky was interested in interpretation of observational data, but nobody of these people were actually involved in any experimental work. And that had some implications, which I'll try to explain in a minute. But talking about these people, in the 60s, it was very typical for all five of them to participate in the famous astrophysical colloquium at Chevron Institute. In my time, in the middle of the 70s, I was lucky only once. Once in my life, I saw all five of them in the same room of conference hall of Chevron Institute. Well, the room probably smaller than this one. It was in September 1975. Sadly, a few weeks later, Solomon Kipinger passed away. He was actually a lecturer of our class, and only one lecture was given by him. So these people dominated the landscape of astrophysics in Moscow in the 60s. But as I said, they were all theoreticians. And because of that, or maybe because of the other reason, they were theoreticians, not experimentalists. Anyway, the experimental observation work in Soviet Union at that time was not terribly successful, I would say, with some exceptions. And one of the exceptions was actually related to this facility, already mentioned by Ken as a secret unknown facility. Yes, it was an antenna facility built in, well, undisclosed location somewhere. Now we know it's in Crimea, but it wasn't announced that. And here actually is a panoramic view of this antenna farm at the small village of Vitina near Yevpatoria. It was the main communication center of the Soviet space program, run by the military, indeed. The first foreigner allowed to visit this facility was Sir Gordon Lovell, and that was described in his book, Astronomer by Chance, a very interesting reading, actually. The antenna itself is a piece of engineering art. As you can see, it consists of 8 dishes, each parabolic dish 16 meters in diameter. So the total effective area is about 900 meters, about 1,000 meters, square meters. That's why the name of this antenna is ADU 1000 square meters. It was basically solar system intercom. It was built to provide two-way communication for planetary missions, primarily Mars and Venus at that time. It was to be used for command uplink to spacecraft and to data reception, downlink. In principle, this antenna could, and it was actually used for voice communication to manned missions as well. Nominally, it was accurate at distances about up to two astronomical units. Funny, the code name given to this antenna in the military was Pluto. Pluto is actually quite a bit further away, but anyway, the name was Pluto. Interesting that decision to build this antenna was made in the middle of 1959, immediately after successful exercise with making picture of the far side of the moon, and two prominent figures in the Soviet space program, Keldysh, later president of the Academy of Sciences, and the general designer of the space program, Kralyov, were the initiators of building of this facility, this antenna. Construction started in January 1960, and three antennas, not just one, but three antennas of that type were commissioned 10 months later. Amazing. I wish this kind of tempo is available, as it is applicable to our work now. So there were two antennas of that sort for reception, about 1 kilometer apart, and one for transmission, 8.5 kilometers apart, while just reducing the level of radio frequency interference. The chief designer of these antennas was a very talented engineer, Ephraim Korenberg. Of course, his name not known, not published, never, but it was his idea, because of high pressure, to build this antenna from available parts and to maximize utilization of whatever available, and to, interestingly, minimize automation. Well, he was able to do that because according to the overall operational infrastructure of this facility, each antenna was served by one full regiment of officers. You don't need any automation. They just do everything by hand, by orders, etc. So, the design of this antenna was very interesting. 8 parabolic antennas, well, you see them, but key components were actually taken from all other very strange parts. The main rotator in the bottom was actually taken from the battleship, which was to be destroyed at the orders of then Prime Minister of Soviet Union. For sure, he decided that the battleship was not needed, the bombers were not needed, or missiles will do everything they wanted. So, 3 rotators were taken from this battleship called Stalingrad, and it was in Crimea, so it was easy, relatively easy to transport from Sevastopol, the main base, to Yevpatoria, just less than 100 miles. Okay? Then, if you go up higher from that, you see this support construction. This is nothing but a military railway bridge upside down. And the most interesting thing is the axis of a mounting of these antennas. You see this thick tube. These are 2 hulls of Italian submarine, which were taken as reparation in 1945. They were out of use actually. So they were just attached to each other and nose and they were just chopped off. That's it. Well, that's not surprising. It took 10 months actually to do this interesting thing. So 3 facilities were operational by the end of 1960. Well, I happened to be there, well, many times in the past. Last, my latest visit there was in 2007. I found all 3 of them rusting. They're out of use. In fact, I was told that several years ago, 2-3 years ago, one of the antennas was scrapped and sold for metal scrap. 2 of them are still there. Okay, now, how did it happen that Steinmeier Institute, and in particular Shklovsky Group, got access to this otherwise highly classified facility? Well, that's because Shklovsky gained a very high reputation in the leadership of the Soviet space program, primarily because of the success of his involvement in first moon mission, the experiment or operation feature, if you wish, called Artificial Comet. In 1959, it was a big deal to get to the moon launching from Earth. There were no reliable navigation system, and radio people were not yet able to track the spacecraft with necessary accuracy. So, at some point, Korolev spoke to Keldysh, and Keldysh suggested, you know, go to Steinmeier Institute, there are smart guys, maybe they could find some, maybe they can propose something interesting. Korolev himself came to Steinmeier Institute in the beginning of 1959, and Shklovsky immediately suggested, well, why not to use optical devices as optical telescope? And the idea was to put a small balloon with sodium and just explode it somewhere on the cruise part of the trajectory. Now, sodium would scatter solar light, and it would be a bright spot. So Shklovsky immediately calculated on the exactly color envelope that, well, it would be sufficiently bright to see it with a small telescope. Well, it was implemented, it was a great success. Here you see pictures of the artificial comet taken on the flight of rocket to the moon. And well, that resulted in so high visibility of astronomers in the eyes of the leadership of space program that from that time, the group of Shklovsky at Steinmeier Institute was treated in a very special way. That's why several people from Shklovsky group, great astronomers and very young great astronomers, Kurilchik, Kromov and Shovanitsky were allowed to visit and to work the facility in Ekvatoria. I didn't mention here Matvienko, well, he was involved as well, although Matvienko was not actually with Shterberg Institute, he was at Lebedev Institute at that time, but he also joined this team. I won't go in details who did what there, since we talk about variability. Well, that was a task given to Shovanitsky, not to discover variability, no, not at all, just to measure flux density of prominent sources on this sky. That's it. No word about variability, of course. So they used the communication receiver, which was parametric for 921 megahertz. That was a standard communication frequency at that time. Well, their task was just to monitor, to measure flux density of several prominent sources in the sky. And in this work, Shovanitsky was assisted by then graduate student Mikhail Larionov. By the way, in this picture you see Shklovsky reading a central newspaper, Pravda, which describes how astronomers helped to track, navigate lunar missions using artificial comet. Shovanitsky conducted observations for about 8 months, from September 64 to April 1965. Well, this is a picture known from this publication, which appeared in the West first. And, well, I won't go into details. This is just a ratio of flux density as measured, CPA 21 to 3C48, and then CPA 502 to 3C48. It's a very dubious thing. Well, it's just plotted by hand that, well, you can fit there a kind of sinusoidal thing, but not terribly convincing. Nevertheless, it was published as shown here. They actually came to the estimate of the period of this variability. They thought this is periodic, 100 days, and yes, CPA 102, practically the same value of the period as the name of the source, something mysterious about that. There was actually a little bit more extended paper published in Soviet Astronomy in English, but a few months earlier, in Russian edition called the Astronomical Journal, that's the main astronomical journal at that time in Soviet Union. But in that paper you will not find a plot, only a table, which is shown here. There is one mystery here which I cannot understand, and I asked several people, they cannot explain how did it happen. If you look carefully on, in the table, that the earliest observation here is in August 64, and the latest observation sometime in April 65, but the paper was submitted on 17 November 64, so just barely 2 months after the beginning of this observation. How did it happen? I don't understand. The only explanation is that apparently Shovanitsky submitted this paper not knowing what he would publish, actually. So he just wrote, it was not about variability at all. Variability was not the goal of this observation, just needed to measure flux density. That's it. So, what's happened next? Two publications. First, most known in Russia, in 1964. Beginning of 1965 in Astronomical, in Astronomical Journal, not Astronomical, Soviet Astronomy. Then some thrilling component of this story took place. There were weekly colloquia at Shterberg Institute, quite often visited by journalists, science writers. Among them, there was one guy, his name is Alexander Midler. He was the respondent of TASS. TASS was the main source of news from Soviet Union. It was official news agency, so and so he was to cover science for this agency. In fact, he's alive and well. Actually, I spoke to him a few weeks ago, the first time in my life, preparing for this talk, and he explained that his task within task was to find and to describe, as he put it, sensations. It was the task given to task by government to show that Soviet science can do sensations on it. So it was his time. He started to find sensations. All right. So he was, he made friends with astronomers from Stern Institute, and he was quite often at Stern. And once he was there and he just overheard the conversation between Shklovsky and Kardashev about measurements done by Chelyabinsky. Well, all three of them shown here, Chelyabinsky, Shklovsky, and Kardashev. And in the conversation between Shklovsky and Kardashev, somebody of them, and Midler doesn't remember who, Kardashev also doesn't remember, I asked him as well. Somebody of them semi-jokingly said, well, if it is variability and we can't explain it by any natural cause, perhaps it's extraterrestrials, I know. And that is sensation, right? So Midler, after this conversation, asked him, hey, are you serious, guys? And at that point, probably Kardashev, I said to him, yeah, why not? Well, can I write it down? Yeah, sure, go ahead. So Midler immediately wrote it by hand. And as he says, as he tells me now, he was stupid enough not to ask Klotsky and Kardashev to sign it. That would be very strange, you know. But with this piece of paper written by hand, Midler rushed to his bosses at us. And he said, look, extraterrestrials already detect. As he explained me again recently, just 2 weeks ago, he even remembers the time at 16:40, Moscow time, on April 12th, there was a telegram sent by TASS to all news agencies around the world that finally artificial signal detected. All right. The day after, he was invited to editorial office of one of the major newspapers in the Soviet Union, Izvestia, and he was asked very seriously, but it's your news, so please sit down and write for us an article about it. While he was writing, there was a telephone call, and a very special so-called red line, government line of telephones, from Pravda, which was some 3 dB higher than Izvestia. Pravda was absolutely the top. And it was deputy editor-in-chief, very high position at that time, almost ordering this young guy, Midler, to rush immediately for press conference. He had no idea that it was press conference, but apparently, the day after this telegram, there was kind of emergency press conference at Stern Institute. This part of the story I heard from many people, never ever before, Stern Institute, which is otherwise a very quiet place in our astronomy department and the campus of the university, never. They saw so many people with lots of cars and foreign journalists, Midler and many others. In fact, Chelyabinsky wasn't able to get into the room. He was someone else. So it was about this discovery. Well, as Midler explained me recently, he was when he finally entered the room, the press conference was already halfway through or something like that. And Kardashev was answering questions from reporters. And they were actually asking, so are you sure that this is indeed a signal from extraterrestrials? And at that point, as Midler tells now, he was surprised to see that Kardashev was mumbling something. Maybe, but maybe no. Now, at this point, Midler realized that probably he is about to be at least fired, but maybe also it happened because of his writing. What happened even way more interesting, at that very moment, next to me there was a big boss from TAS, the agency. And he was very unhappy with what he is hearing. Well, on one hand, TAS said this telegram now, I saw him and said that I'm not that sure that this is the address. At this very point, somebody from Reuters, I forgot the name, but Miller still remembers the name. He was a chief respondent of Reuters in Moscow. Left the room after this was Khrushchev and proceeded to the lobby of Shevchenko against the rebel staff. Of course, it was known before mobile phones, and just a normal fixed iPhone. And both from TAS just pushed Miller. Just follow him, and this is what he going to say. So he proceeded to Chernikov. And Reuters responded, actually spoke to somebody, in English of course, but nevertheless Miller could understand something, that, well, after all, Soviet scientists are not that sure that this is the rest or might be something else. Well, scandal. Nevertheless, the most interesting thing, I was not able yet to find this telegram itself, but I'm pretty sure I'll find the sample. So I don't know what's written there. What was actually published, I'll show in the next slide. But interesting thing is that the day after this press conference on 14th of April, many papers, newspapers in Soviet Union and in other countries, I believe, can remember that. Came out with headlines that there is some indication of artificial signal from space. And the most interesting comment on that was found by Miller later on, that somewhere, it was either, he doesn't remember, either Washington Post or maybe New York Times, there was interesting statement by somebody from congressman, finally we have something called the newspaper which actually eclipses the Vietnam War. Anyway, as a result of, why extraterrestrials actually came in the picture? It was just the right time. In the middle of the 60s, everything related to extraterrestrial civilization was somehow linked to writings of the same people who were involved here. The famous book of Schlossky, 1962, The Universe, Life and Mind, was published. Actually, the second edition was already available in 1962. The first one was written in '62, for the fifth anniversary of Sputnik, and then another one. By the way, by now there are 7 editions, the latest one 3 years ago. There were several articles, several papers, and Kardashov famous paper on three types of civilization. So it was in everybody's mind. And something happened of that sort, and the same people involved. So it was kind of natural, it was perception, general perception. Well, finally, it happened. Now, after this press conference, the day after, the most important newspaper in Soviet Union, Pravda, published an article on some radio astronomy discovery. I think that's only the second example of major newspaper publishing something about radio astronomy. The first, of course, is New York Times, May 5, 1933, that's the discovery of cosmic noise by Carl Janssen. I think that's the second example. But here, one step further. The Janssen article is in New York Times, no plots, no figure. But here, something absolutely amazing. Never before, but neither before nor after, I've seen in Pravda, in history, actually, figure of any kind of physical process. By the way, the picture here is different from what you can see in variable star ability. And that's the only publication where this version of the series is shown. Then it was actually repeated in some books and otherwise, but that's the only origin. Now, whether you trust this or not, it's up to you. It's very questionable whether you can put this trapezoidal curve in this reliability, but anyway. What is important here is to see the context in which it happens. So it's 14th April 65. It's just 2 days after 12th April, which in Soviet Union and even now in Russia is celebrated as the Day of Cosmonauts. Gagarin flight, 12th April 1961. By the way, the first shuttle flight, Valamyev, 12th April 1989. That's much later. So it is a kind of national holiday, and all news are focused on this day on space. Moreover, in 1965, just weeks before this event, it was the high point of Soviet space program. In fact, the last highest point of space program in Soviet Union, the first spacewalk by Alexei Leonov. And on the same page of Pravda paper, you can see this article about reliability and possible extraterrestrial nature, extraterrestrial intelligence, but also another paper here describing the event on Vostok 2 spacecraft where Leonov made his first historic spacewalk. By the way, this paper, if you read it now, is very funny. There is no word of truth. It's absolutely, it's artificial, it's made up completely. Nevertheless, it happened on the same day, and yes, that was a very coherent publication, if you wish. Well, one space news and another space news, so that's fine. Now, what happened after that? Of course, the hypothesis of extraterrestrial nature, it was not taken very seriously, neither within the group nor anywhere else. As Dave Jonesy explained in the morning session today, it took some time to confirm the variability of extragalactic sources, and yes, we now know that they are variable. Gennady Shalamitsky himself switched to something totally different, and for the rest of his professional life he was mostly involved in submillimeter and infrared astronomy. Nevertheless, his discovery triggered some interest and some high interest to variability of all sorts, and in particular it was understood very soon after this discovery that interstellar medium and planetary medium are responsible for variability, and that created a very interesting and prominent school of studies of variability in Moscow, in Pushkin in particular, for pulsars and people like Shishov and actually all pulsar experts in Pushkin began their work from that time in 65. To some extent, the discovery of variability also triggered interest to space VLBI, not only VLBI as such, but space VLBI. So what we have now in orbit, very last one, in some sense, the roots go to the discovery of variability made by Shalamitsky. In the period from about 1970 to 1990, about 20 PhD were defended successfully, somehow related to variability. Half of them on pulses and sensation, etc. Here I show this one picture, most faces I think recognizable. Shalamitsky, Bill Hobart, and McLean, and Slavisic. Why this picture is relevant here? Although Kent thinks slightly different, but in Moscow there is a belief that Bill Hobart was the first foreigner to whom just a glimpse of the story of discovery of variability was explained earlier. Not in publication, but Kent thinks that he learned something 2 years earlier. Well, I don't know. It was before my time, I don't know. I only know that indeed this is a problem for creating some kind of legacy of radio astronomy in Moscow. Well, that's a story as it is known now. Here is a list of people who were kind enough to help to talk to me in preparation for this presentation. Thank you.
A question. What a wonderful talk, especially to the end of the symposium. I had heard that there was a song, CTA-102, and which I assumed, I didn't know what it was about. But thanks to Mr. Google, I can tell you that it was performed by The Birds, a folk rock band, written in 1967, and the lyrics go, CTA-102, year over year, receiving you. Singles tell us that you're there, we can hear them loud and clear. We just want to let you know that we're ready for it to go out to the universe. We don't hear anything at first. On a radio telescope, science tells us that there's hope, a life in other planets and bodies.
If you just Google that, you can actually hear it play.
And it's YouTube.
Yeah, and what they've done is that lyric, and then they run it backwards. And so it sounds like some velvety book from a I should also tell you that Gene Epstein, I think, recruited that song. Gene wrote a paper, he was doing variability at aerospace. He wrote a paper on 3 millimeter variability of PC-273, which coincidentally I refereed. It was a perfectly straightforward paper, no issue. But after it came back to him, he added in the paper a reference to this song for The Birds. Which, if you find, I think it was the early 1970s. If you go back and look at it, you'll find a reference in Gene's paper to this. You know, it's perfectly legitimate, but he snuck it in after he was refereed.
I think we're going to close. I think let us thank all the speakers.